It looks as if the old wizard has put his trust in the two thieves instead. The real question is, why would they all be here? It can't be coincidence that he turns up in this little backwater village at the precise moment when the Emperor is about to be crowned.
He couldn't know of our plans, Guy told him.
He is a wizard. They're good at discovering things. Regardless, you might want to see if you can determine what he's up to.
Remember to keep your distance, Saldor added. We don't want to tree this fox until we know he's led us to his den.
Hadrian folded the blanket twice in length, then rolled it tight, buckling the resulting cloth log with two leather straps. He had all the gear left to them on the ground in neat piles. They still had all their camping gear, food and feed. Royce had his saddle, bridle and bags, but Hadrian had lost his tack along with his weapons when Millie had disappeared. It would be impossible to ride double and haul the gear. They would have to load Mouse up with everything and walk the trip home.
There you are.
Hadrian looked up to see Theron striding from the direction of the Botherwicks, heading for the well with an empty bucket in his hand.
We didn't see you around last night. Was worried something happened to you.
Looks like everyone had a lucky night, Hadrian said.
Everyone in the village? Yeah. But I don't think them fellows up at the castle did so well. We heard a lot of shouting and screaming, and they ain't celebrating this morning. My guess is their plan to kill the beast didn't go as hoped.
The farmer scanned the piles.
Packing, eh? So you're leaving too?
I don't see why not. There's nothing keeping us here anymore. How's Thrace?
Doing well. Rubbing elbows with the nobility, she tells me. She's walking around just fine. The headaches are mostly gone. We'll be on our way tomorrow morning, I expect.
Good to hear that, Hadrian said. Who's your friend?
Theron motioned to the dwarf seated a few feet away in the shade of a poplar tree.
Oh, yeah. Theron, meet Magnus. He's not so much a friend as an associate.
He thought about that and added,
Actually, he's more like an enemy I'm keeping an eye on.
Theron nodded, but with a puzzled look, and the dwarf grumbled something neither caught.
What about my lesson?
Theron asked.
Are you kidding? I don't really see the point in a lesson if you're both leaving tomorrow.
You have something else to do. Besides, the road is a dangerous place, and it wouldn't hurt to know a few more tricks. Or is this your way of saying you want money now?
No.
Hadrian waved his hand at the farmer.
Grab this sticks.
By noon, the sun was hot, and Hadrian had worked up a sweat sparring with Theron, who was showing real improvement. Magnus sat on an overturned well bucket, watching the two with interest. Hadrian explained proper form, how to obtain penetrating thrusts and grips, which was hard using only rake handles.
If you hold a sword with both hands, you lose versatility and reach, but you gain tremendous power. A good fighter knows when to switch from two hands to one, and vice versa. If you're defending against someone with longer reach, you'd better be using one hand. But if you need to drive your sword deep through heavy armor, assuming you aren't holding a shield in your offhand, grip the pommel with both palms and thrust. Remember to yell as you do so, like I taught you before. Then drive home the blow using all your power. A solid breastplate won't stop a sword thrust. They aren't designed to. Armor prevents a swing or a slice, and can deflect the point of a thrust. That's why professional fighters wear smooth, unadorned armor. You always see these princes and dukes with all their fancy gilded breastplates and light, thin metal heavily engraved. It's like walking around in a death trap. Of course, they don't really fight. They have knights do that for them. They just walk around and look pretty. So, The idea is, when you thrust, you aim for a crease, groove, or seam in the armour, something that'll catch and hold the tip. The armpits are excellent targets, are up under the nose guard. Drive a 4-foot sword up under a nose guard, and you don't have to worry much about a counterattack. How can you teach that poor fellow anything without swords? They both turn to see Marvin Pickering walking toward them in his simple blue tunic. Gone was the dapper Lord of Galilin. Instead, he looked much like the boy Hadrian had first seen at Drondel Fields. In his hands, he carried two swords, and slung over his back were two small round shields. "I saw you from the walls, and thought you might like to borrow these," he said, handing a sword and shield to Theron, who accepted them awkwardly. "They are my and Fanon's spares." Theron eyed the young man suspiciously, then looked to Hadrian. "Go ahead," Hadrian told him, wiping the sweat from his brow with his sleeve. "He's right. You should know the feel of the real thing." When Theron appeared confused by how to hold the shield, Marvin began instructing him, showing the farmer where his arm slipped through the leather straps. "See, Hadrian? It helps to actually teach your pupil how to put on a real shield. Unless, of course, you expect he'll be spending all of his time warring against maple trees. Where are your weapons, anyway?" Hadrian looked sheepish. "I lost them." "Don't you carry enough for 5 people?" "I've had a bad week." "And who might you be?" Marvin asked, looking at the dwarf. Hadrian started to answer, then stopped himself. Ulric had likely told Marvin all about the dwarf who had murdered his father. "Him? He's... nobody." "Okay." Marvin laughed, raising his hand and waving. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Nobody." He then went and sat on the edge of the well, where he folded his arms across his chest. "Go on. Show me what he's taught you." Hadrian and Theron returned to fighting, but slower now, as the sharp swords made Theron nervous. He soon became frustrated and turned to Marvin, scowling.
"You any good with these things?"
The young man raised an eyebrow in surprise. "My dear sir, weren't we already introduced? My name is Marvin Pickering." He grinned. Theron narrowed his eyes in confusion, glanced at Hadrian, who said nothing, then faced the boy once more.
"I asked if you knew how to use a sword, son, not your name."
"But I... oh, never mind. Yes, I've been trained in the use of a sword."
"Well, I spent all my life on farms, or in villages not much bigger than this one, and I've never had much chance to see fellas beating each other with blades. It might help if an eye was to see what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, all proper-like."
"You want a demonstration?"
Theron nodded.
"I've no way of knowing if Hadrian here even knows what he's doing."
"All right," Marvin said, flexing his fingers and shaking his hands as he walked forward. He had a bright smile on his face, as if Theron had just invited him to play his favourite game. The two paired off. Magnus and Theron took seats in the dirt and watched as Marvin and Hadrian first walked through the basic moves and then demonstrated each at actual combat speed. Hadrian would explain each manoeuvre and comment on the action afterward.
"See there? Marvin thought I was going to slice inward toward his thigh and dropped his guard briefly. He did that because I told him to by suggesting with a dip of my shoulder that this was my intention, so before I even started my stroke, I knew what Marvin was going to do, because I was the one dictating it. In essence, I knew what he would do before he did, and in battle that's very handy."
"Enough of the lessons," Marvin said, clearly irritated at being the illustration of a fencing mistake. "Let's show him a real demonstration."
"Looking for a rematch?" Hadrian asked,
curious if it was luck.
Hadrian smiled and muttered, "Pickerings."
He took off his shirt and, wiping his face and hands, threw it on the grass, and raised his sword to ready position. Morvin lunged, and immediately the two began to fight. The swords sang as they cut the air so fast their movements blurred. Hadrian and Morvin danced around on the balls of their feet, shuffling in the dirt so briskly that a small cloud rose to knee height. "By Mar!" the old farmer exclaimed. Then, abruptly, they stopped, both panting from the exertion. Morvin glared at Hadrian with a look that was both amazed and irritated.
"You're playing with me." "I thought that was the point. You don't really want me to kill you." "Well, no, but, well, like he said, by Mar, I've never seen anyone fight like you do. You're amazing."
"I thought you both were pretty amazing," Theron remarked. "I've never seen anything like it."
"I have to agree," Magnus chimed in.
The dwarf was on his feet, nodding his head. Hadrian walked over to the well and poured half a bucket over himself, then shook the water from his hair.
"Seriously, Hadrian?" Morvin asked. "Where did you learn it?"
"From a man named Danbury Blackwater."
"Blackwater? Isn't that your name?"
Hadrian nodded, and a melancholy look stole over his face. "He was my father."
"Was?"
"He died."
"Was he a warrior? A general?"
"Blacksmith."
"Blacksmith?"
Morvin asked in disbelief.
"In a village not much bigger than this. You know, the guy who makes horseshoes, rakes, pots."
"Are you telling me a village blacksmith knew the secret disciplines of the Teshlors?
I recognized the Tekchin moves, the ones my father taught me. The rest, I can only assume, were from the other lost disciplines of the Teshlors."
Morvin drew blank stares from everyone.
"The Teshlors?"
He looked around. More stares. He rolled his eyes and sighed.
"Heathens. I'm surrounded by ignorant heathens. The Teshlors were the greatest knights ever to have lived. They were the personal bodyguards of the Emperor. It's said they were taught the five disciplines of combat from Navron himself, only one of which is the Tekchin. And the knowledge of the Tekchin alone is what has made a legend out of the Pickering dynasty. Your father clearly knew the Tekchin, and apparently other Teshlor disciplines that I thought had been lost for nearly 1,000 years, and you're telling me he was a blacksmith? He was probably the greatest warrior of his time. And you don't know what your father did before you were born?"
"I assume the same thing he did afterward."
"Then how did he know how to fight?"
Hadrian considered this.
"I just assumed he picked it up serving in the local army. Several of the men in the village served his lordship as men-at-arms. I assumed he saw combat. He used to talk like he had."
"Did you ever ask him?"
The thunder of hooves interrupted them as three men on horseback entered the village from the direction of the Margrave's castle. The riders were all in black and red, with the symbol of a broken crown on their chests. At their head rode a tall, thin man with long black hair and a short, trimmed beard.
"Excellent swordsmanship," the lead man said.
He rode right up to Hadrian and reined in his animal roughly. The black stallion was draped in a scarlet and black caparison, complete with braided tassels, a scarlet headpiece with a foot-tall black plume spouting from his head. The horse snorted and stomped.
"I was wondering why the son of Count Pickering wasn't partaking in the combat today, but I see now you found a worthier partner to spar against. Who would this delightful warrior be, and why haven't I seen you at the castle?"
"I'm not here to compete for the crown," Hadrian said simply, slipping on his shirt.
"No? Pity. You certainly appear to be worthy of a chance. What's your name?"
"Hadrian."
"Ah. Good to meet you, Sir Hadrian."
"Just Hadrian."
"I see. Do you live here? Just Hadrian?"
"No."
The horseman seemed
less than pleased with the curt answer, and nudged his horse closer in a menacing manner. The animal puffed out a hot, moist breath into Hadrian's face.
"Then what are you doing here?"
"Just passing through," Hadrian replied in his usual amiable manner. He even managed a friendly little smile.
"Really? Just passing through Dahlgren? To where in the world, might I ask, is Dahlgren on the way?"
"Just about everywhere, depending on your perspective, don't you think? I mean, all roads lead somewhere, don't they?" He was tired of being on the defensive and took a verbal swing.
"Is there a reason you're so interested?" "I'm Sentinel Luis Guy, and I'm in charge of managing the contest. I need to know if everyone participating is listed."
"I already told you I wasn't here for the contest."
"So you did," Guy said,
and slowly looked around at the others, taking particular notice of Magnus.
"You are just passing through," you said, "but perhaps those travelling with you wish to be listed on the roll."
A feint, perhaps? Hadrian decided to parry anyway.
"No one I'm with will want to be on that list."
"No one you're with?" Hadrian gritted his teeth. It was a feint. Hadrian mentally scolded himself.
"So, you're not alone," the sentinel observed. "Where are the others?"
"I couldn't tell you."
"No?"
Hadrian shook his head. Fewer words, smaller chance of mistakes.
"Really? Do you mean they could be washing over the falls right now and you couldn't care less?"
"I didn't say that," Hadrian replied, irritated.
"But you see no need to know where they are. They're grown men."
The sentinel smiled.
"And who are these men? Please tell me, so that I might inquire of them later, perhaps."
Hadrian's eyes narrowed as he realized too late his mistake. The man before him was clever. Too clever.
"Did you forget their names too?"
Luis Guy inquired, leaning forward in his saddle.
"No."
Hadrian tried to hold him off while he struggled to think.
"Then what are they?"
"Well," he began, wishing he had his own swords rather than a borrowed one.
"Like I said, I don't know where both of them are. Morven is here, of course, but I've no idea where Fannin has got to."
"Surely you are mistaken. The Pickerings travelled with me and the rest of the entourage," Guy pointed out.
"Yes, they were, but they're planning on returning home with me."
Guy's eyes narrowed.
"So you are saying that you travelled all the way out here alone, passing through, as you put it, and just happened to join up with the Pickerings?"
Hadrian smiled at the sentinel. It was weak, clumsy, and the fencing equivalent of dropping his sword and tackling his opponent to the ground, but it was all he could do.
"Is this true, Pickering?"
"Absolutely," Morven replied without hesitation. Guy looked back at Hadrian.
"How convenient for you,"
he said, disappointed.
"Well, then don't let me keep you from your practice. Good day, gentlemen."
They all watched as the three men rode off toward the river trail.
"That was creepy," Morven remarked, staring off in their direction. "It can never be good when any sentinel takes an interest in you, much less Luis Guy."
"What's his story?" Hadrian asked.
"I really only know rumours. He's a zealot for the church, but I know many even in the church who are scared of him. He's the kind of person that can make kings disappear. He's also rumoured to be obsessed with finding the heir of Novron."
"Aren't all, Siret?"
"According to church doctrine, sure. But he really is, which explains why he's here."
"And the two with him?"
"Siret, the Knights of Nephron. They're the Sentinel's personal shadow army. They're answerable to no king or nation, just to Sentinels and the Patriarch." Morven looked at Hadrian. "You might want to keep that sword. It looks like a bad time to be without your weapons." Although he had put his lantern out long before the creature's return, Royce could see just fine.
Light permeated the walls of Avamparthe, seeping through the stone as if it were smoky glass. It was daylight outside, of that he was certain, as the colour of light had changed from dim blue to soft white. As the sun rose, the interior of the citadel became an illuminated world of wondrous colour and beauty. Ceilings stretched in tall, airy arches, meeting hundreds of feet above the floor, and giving the illusion of not being indoors at all, but rather in a place where the horizon was merely lost in mist. The roar of the nearby cataracts, tamed by the walls of the tower, was a soft, muffled, undeniably soothing hum. Thin, gossamer banners hung from the lofty heights. Each shimmered with symbols Royce didn't understand. They might have been standards of royalty, rules of law, directions to halls, or meaningless decorations. All Royce knew was that even in the wake of 1,000 years, the detailed pattern still appeared fluid and vibrant. It was artistry beyond mortal hands, born of a culture unfathomable. Being the only elven structure Royce had ever entered, it was his only glimpse into that world, and it felt oddly peaceful. Still and silent, it was beautiful. Although it looked nothing like anything Royce had ever seen, his reason fought against the growing sensation that somehow all this was familiar. Royce felt calm as he wandered the corridors. The very shapes and shadows touched chords in his mind he never realized were there. It all spoke to him in a language he couldn't understand. He caught only a word or a phrase, in an avalanche of sensations that both mystified and captivated him, as he wandered aimlessly, like a man blinded by a dazzling light. He walked from room to room, upstairs and across balconies, following no conscious course, but merely moving, staring, and listening. Royce noticed with concern that every movement he made was recorded clearly in centuries of dust that blanketed the interior. Still, he was fascinated to discover that where he disturbed the dust, the floor revealed a glossy surface as clear as still water. Passing through the various chambers, he felt as if he were in a museum, lost in a moment of frozen time. Plates were still out before empty chairs, some fallen on their sides, overturned in the confusion and alarm of nearly a millennium earlier. Books lay open to pages someone had been reading 900 years before, yet Royce knew that even to that person who had sat there so long ago, this place, this tower, had been ancient. Aside from its dramatic history, by its age alone, Avamparthe would be a monument, a sacred structure to the elves, a link to an ancient era. This was not a citadel. He didn't know how he knew, but he was certain this was something far more than a mere fortress. Ezra Harden had left Royce almost immediately after entering the tower and pointing him in the direction he was now following. He had told Royce that he would find the sword he sought somewhere above the entrance, but that the wizard's path led elsewhere. It had been hours now since they had parted, and the light outside was already starting to dim. Royce still hadn't found the sword. Sights, sounds, and smells sidetracked him. It was too much to process at once, too much to classify, and soon he found himself lost. He started to follow his trail in reverse, when he discovered his footprints overlapped, leaving him a path that moved in circles. He was starting to become concerned when he heard a new sound. Unlike everything he had encountered so far, this noise was disturbing. It was the thick, rhythmical resonance of heavy breathing. Every path open to the thief was marred with his own tracks, except one. This led to yet another stair, where the breathing was louder. How many floors up, Royce had wondered. He wasn't certain, but he knew he hadn't come across any swords. Slowly, and as silently as he could, he began to creep upward. He hadn't gone more than 5 steps when he spotted his first sword. It lay blanketed in dust on one side beside a bony form. What cloth there might have been was gone, but the armor remained. Farther up, he spotted another and yet another. There were 2 different types of bodies, human in broad, heavy breastplates and greaves, and elves in delicate blue armor. This was the last stand, the last defense to protect the Emperor. Elves and men fallen one upon the other. Royce reached down and slid his thumb along the flat of the blade at his feet. As the dust wiped clear, the amazing shine of the elven steel glimmered as if new, but no etching was on it. Royce looked up the stairs and reluctantly stepped over the bodies as he continued his climb. The breathing grew louder and deeper, like wind blowing through an echoing cavern. A room lay ahead, and with the silence of a cat's shadow, Royce crept inside. The chamber was round, with yet another staircase leading up. As he entered, he could feel and smell fresh air. Tall, thin windows allowed unfettered shafts of light into the room, but Royce felt that somewhere above him a much larger window lay. At last, Royce found a rack of elven swords mounted ceremoniously to the wall in ornate cases. Divided from the rest of the room by a delicate chain, the area appeared as a memorial, a remembrance set aside in honor. A plaque on a pedestal stood before the rack, and on the walls were numerous lines of elven script carved into the stone. Royce knew only a few words, and those before him had been written with such flair and embellishment that he was at a loss to recognize even a single word, although he was certain he recognized several letters. On the rack were dozens of swords. They all appeared to be identical, and without having to touch them, Royce could see the etchings clearly cut into the blades, and the notches hewn into the metal. One spot remained vacant. With a silent sigh, he steadied himself and began to climb upward once more. With each step, the air grew fresher. Currents banished dust to the cracks and corners. Along the stair, more openings and hallways appeared to either side, but Royce had a hunch and continued to climb, moving toward the sound of breathing. At last, the steps ended, and Royce looked up at open sky. Above him was a circular balcony with sculpted walls like petals on a flower. Statues that had once lined this open-air pavilion lay in broken heaps on the floor. At their center rested the malevolent, sleeping figure of the Gilarabrin, an enormous, black-scaled lizard with wings of grey membrane and bone. It lay curled, its head on its tail, its body heaving with deep, long breaths. Muscular claws were armed with 4 12-inch-long black nails. Encrusted with dried blood, they left deep grooves in the surface of the floor where they scraped in the beast's sleep. Long, sharp fangs protruded from beneath leathery lips, as did a row of frightening teeth that followed no visible scheme but seemed to mesh together like a wild fence of needles. Ears lay back upon its head, its eyes cloaked by broad lids, beneath which pupils darted about in a fretful slumber, of what dark visages Royce couldn't begin to imagine. The long tail, barbed at the end with a saber-like bone, twitched. Royce caught himself staring, and cursed at his own stupidity. It was a sight, to be certain, but this was no time to be distracted. Focus was all that separated him from certain death. He'd always hated places with animals. Hounds bellowed at the slightest sound or smell. He had managed to step past many a sleeping dog, but there had been a few that had managed to sense him without warning. He mentally gripped himself and pulled his eyes away from the giant to study the rest of the room.
It was a shambles, broken fixtures and rubble. On closer study, however, Royce noticed that the rubble held terrible treasures. He recognized torn bits of May Drundle's dress, matted with dark stains. Entangled within its folds was a bit of scalp and a long lock of grey hair. Other equally disturbing items lay around him. Arms, feet, fingers, hands, all cast aside like shrimp tails. He spotted Millie, Hadrian's bay mare, or rather one of her rear legs and her tail. Not too far away, he was stunned to see Millie's saddle and Hadrian's swords. Luckily, they were within easy reach. As he began to move around the pile, inching his way with the slow discipline of a mantis on the hunt, he saw something. The bodies and torn clothes lay atop the pile of bones and stone, but deep beneath, on the bottom stratum of built-up sediment, Royce caught the singular glint of mirrored steel. It was only a tiny patch, no larger than a small coin, which was what he initially took it for, but its brilliance was unmistakable. It possessed the same gleam as the swords on the stairs and in the rack below. Barely breathing, each movement keyed to a painfully slow pace that might defy even a direct look, Royce stole closer to the beast and his vile treasure trove. He slipped his hand under the strands of Millie's tail and meticulously began to draw forth the blade. It came loose with little effort or sound, but even before he had it free, Royce knew something was wrong. It wasn't heavy enough. Even given that elven blades might weigh dramatically less, it was ridiculously light. He soon realized why, as he drew forth only part of a broken blade. Seeing the etching on the unnotched metal, Royce realized his hunch was correct. The Gilarabrin was no animal, no dumb beast trained to kill. This conjured demon was self-aware enough to realize it had only one mortal fear in this world, a blade with its name on it. It took precautions. The monster had broken the blade, severing the name and rendering it useless. He couldn't see the other half of the sword, but it seemed obvious to him where it lay. The remainder of the sword rested in the one place from which Royce couldn't steal it, beneath the sleeping body of the Gilarabrin itself. Chapter 11 Gilarabrin. It was nearing dusk when Royce, hauling three swords over his shoulder, found Hadrian and Magnus waiting at the well. The village was empty, its inhabitants holed up in their hovels, and the night was quiet except for the faint sounds of distant activity coming from the castle. "It's about time," Hadrian said, jumping to his feet at Royce's approach. "Here's your gear." Royce handed Hadrian his weapons. "Be careful next time where you stow it. I do have more important things to do than be your personal valet." Hadrian happily took the swords and belts and began strapping them on. "I was starting to worry the church had grabbed you."
"Church?" Royce asked.
"Louis Guy was harassing me earlier."
"The sentinel?"
"Yeah, he was asking about my partners, and rode off toward the river, and I haven't seen him come back. I got the impression he might be fishing for Ezra." "Where is Ezra, anyway? Did you leave him at the river?"
"He didn't stop back here," Royce asked. They shook their heads. "Doesn't mean anything. He'd be a fool to come back to the village. He's likely hiding in the trees."
"Assuming he didn't get swept away by the river," Hadrian said. "Why did you leave him?"
"He left me with a very don't-follow-me attitude, which under normal circumstances would ensure that I followed him, but I had other things on my mind. Before I knew it, the sun was going down. I thought he had already left."
"So, did you find anything valuable inside? Gems?
gold?
Royce suddenly felt stupid. You know, it never even crossed my mind to look.
What?
I completely forgot about it.
So what did you do in there all day?
Royce pulled the bare half-blade from his belt. It gleamed even in the faint light.
All the other swords were in a neat display case, but I found this buried almost directly under the Gilabran's foot.
Its foot?
Hadrian said, stunned.
You saw it?
Royce nodded with a grimace. And trust me, it isn't a sight you want to see drunk or sober.
You think it broke the blade?
Kinda makes you wonder, doesn't it?
So where's the other piece?
I'm guessing it's sleeping on it, but I wasn't about to try and roll it over to look.
I'm surprised you didn't wait until it left.
With our client leaving in the morning, what's the point? If it was an easy grab, if I could see it and didn't have to spend hours digging through, well, stuff, fine, but I'm not about to risk my neck for Ezra's personal war with the church. Besides, remember the hounds in Blythen Castle?
Hadrian nodded with a sick look on his face.
If it can smell scents, I didn't want to be around when it wakes up. The way I see it, Thrace has her father, Ezra has access to the tower, and Rufus will rid the village of the Gilarabrin. I say our work here is done.
Royce looked at the dwarf, then back at Hadrian.
Thanks for keeping an eye on him.
He drew his dagger.
What? Wait!
The dwarf backpedaled as Royce advanced.
We had a deal!
Royce grinned at him. Do I really look trustworthy to you?
Royce, you can't,
Hadrian said.
The thief looked at him and chuckled.
Are you kidding? Look at him. If I can't slit his throat in 10 seconds, tops, I'll buy you a beer as soon as we get back to Alban. Tell me when you're ready to count.
No, I mean, he's right. You made a bargain with him. You can't go back on it.
Oh, please. This little dwarf tried to kill me and damn near succeeded. You want me to let him go because I said I would? Hey, he lived a whole day longer for helping us. That's plenty reward.
Royce!
What?
The thief rolled his eyes. You aren't serious. He killed Amrath.
It was a job. And you aren't a member of the Royal Guard. He upheld his end just as agreed, and there's no benefit to killing him.
Enjoyment, Royce said. Enjoyment and satisfaction are benefits.
Hadrian continued to glare.
Royce shook his head and sighed. All right, okay, he can live.
It's stupid, but he can live. Happy?
Royce looked up at the great motte of the castle, where already the torches of that night's contestants were assembling.
It's nearly dark. We need to get inside. Where's the best seat for this dinner theatre I hear they've been holding at the castle? When I say best, I mean safest.
We still have an open invitation to the Bothwicks. Theron is there now, and we've been...
A screeching cry from the direction of the river cut through the night.
What's in the land of Novron's ghost is that?
Magnus asked.
You think maybe Lizard Wings found out his rattle has been stolen?
Hadrian asked apprehensively. Royce looked back toward the trees, and then at his friend.
I think we'd better find a better place to hide tonight than the Botherwicks.
Where? Hadrian asked. If it comes looking for that blade, it'll rip every house apart until it finds it, and we already know the local architecture doesn't pose much of a challenge. It's going to kill everyone in the village.
We could run them all to the castle. There might still be time, Royce suggested.
No good, Hadrian countered. The guards won't let us in. The forest, maybe?
The trees only slow it down. It won't stop it any more than the houses.
Damn it!
Hadrian looked around desperately.
I should have built the pit out in the village.
What about the well here? The dwarf asked, peering into the wooden-rimmed hole.
Royce and Hadrian looked at each other.
I feel so stupid right now, Royce said.
Hadrian ran to the bell, grabbed hold of the dangling rope, and began to pull it. The bell, intended for the future Church of Dahlgren,
raised the alarm.
"Keep ringing it!" Hadrian yelled at Magnus, as he and Royce raced to the houses, sweeping their cloth drapes aside and banging on the frames. "Get out! Everyone out!" they yelled. "Your houses won't protect you tonight. Get in the well! Everyone in the well, now!"
"What's going on?"
Russell Botherwick asked, peering out into the darkness.
"No time to explain," Hadrian shouted back. "Get in the well if you want to live."
"But the church, they're supposed to save us,"
Selene Brockton said, huddling in a blanket in the arch of her doorway.
"Are you willing to bet your life? You're all going to have to trust me. If I'm wrong, you'll spend one miserable night, but if I'm right and you don't listen, you'll all die."
"That's good enough for me," Theron said, storming out of the Botherwick house, buttoning his shirt, his massive figure and loud, harsh voice commanding everyone's attention. "And it had better be good enough for the lot of you, too. Hadrian has done more to save this village from death in the past few days than all of us, and all of them combined. If he says sleep in the well tonight, then by the beard of Maribor, that's what I'll do. I don't care if the beast was known to be dead. I'd still do it, and any of you who refuse, why, you deserve to be eaten."
The inhabitants of Dahlgren ran to the well. Loops were tied into the rope for footholds, and while the well was wide enough to lower four or even five people at a time, because they didn't trust the strength of the windlass, they lowered them in groups of only twos and threes, depending on weight. Although people moved quickly and orderly, obeying Hadrian's instruction without argument, the process was excruciatingly slow. Magnus volunteered to go in and drive pegs into the walls to form footholds. Young Hal, Arvid, and Pearl, being too small to go down first, raced around the village fetching more shafts of wood for the dwarf to drive into the sides. Tad Botherwick went down and worked with Magnus, feeding him the wooden spikes as the little dwarf built makeshift platforms.
"Whoa, mister!" Thad's voice echoed out of the mouth of the well. "I ain't never seen no one use a hammer like that. It took 6 weeks to build up these walls, and I swear you look like you could have done it in 6 hours."
Outside, Hadrian, Theron, Vince and Dylan did the work of lowering villagers in. Hadrian lined them up, sending women and children down first into the darkness, where only a single candle that Tad held for Magnus revealed anything below.
"How long?" Hadrian asked, as they waited to lower the next set down.
"It would have been here by now if it had flown the moment we heard it," Royce replied. "It must be searching the tower. That gives us some time, but I don't know how much."
"Get up in a tree and yell when you see it."
When everyone was in, Hadrian lowered Theron and Dylan, leaving only Hadrian, Vince, and Royce above ground, where they waited for Magnus to finish the last set of wall pegs. Up in a poplar tree, Royce stood out on a thin branch, scanning the sky while listening to the dwarf hammering the last stakes into place.
"Here it comes," he shouted, spotting a shadow darting across the stars.
Seconds later, the Galarabrin screamed from somewhere above the dark canopy of leaves, and the three cringed, but nothing happened. They stood still, staring into the darkness around them, listening. Another cry ripped through the night. The Galarabrin flew straight for the torches of the manor house. Royce spotted it in the night sky flying over the hill where the next challenger for the crown prepared to meet the beast. It descended, then rose once more. It issued another screech, then the beast let loose a roar and fire exploded from its mouth. Instantly, everything grew brighter as fire engulfed the hillside.
"That's new," Hadrian declared nervously as he watched the ghastly sight.
The crowd of challengers lost their lives with hardly the time to scream.
"Magnus, hurry!"
"All set! Go! Climb down!" the dwarf shouted back.
"Wait!" Tad cried. "Where's Pearl?"
"She's looking for wood," Vince said. "I'll get her."
Hadrian grabbed his arm.
"It's too dangerous. Get in the well. Royce will go."
"I will?"
Royce asked, surprised.
"It's lousy being the only one to see in the dark sometimes, isn't it?"
Royce cursed and ran off, pausing in homes and sheds to call the little girl's name as loudly as he dared.
It got easier to see his way as the light from the hill grew larger and brighter. The Galarabran screamed repeatedly, and Royce looked over his shoulder to see the castle walls engulfed in flames.
"Royce!" Hadrian shouted. "It's coming!"
Royce gave up stealth.
"Pearl!"
he yelled aloud.
"Here!"
she screamed, darting out from the trees. He grabbed the little girl up in his arms and raced for the well.
"Run, damn it!"
Hadrian shouted, holding the rope for them.
"Forget the rope. Get down and catch her."
While Royce was still sprinting across the yard, Hadrian slid down the coil. Thrump, thrump, thrump. Hugging Pearl close to his chest, Royce reached the well and jumped. The little girl screamed as they fell in together. An instant later, there came a loud, unearthly scream and a terrible vibration as the world above the well erupted in a brilliant light, accompanied by a thunderous roar. Arista paced the length of the little room, painfully aware of Benice's head turning side to side, following her every move. The old woman was smiling at her. She always smiled at her, and Arista was about ready to gouge her eyes out. She was used to her tower, where even Hilfred gave her space, but for more than a week she had been subjected to constant company. Bernice, her ever-present shadow. She had to get out of the room, to get away. She was tired of being stared at, of being watched after like a child. She walked to the door.
"Where are you going, Highness?"
Bernice was quick to ask.
"Out," she said.
"Out where?"
"Just out."
Bernice stood up.
"Let me get our cloaks.
I'm going alone."
"Oh, no, Your Highness," Bernice said. "That's not possible."
Arista glared at her. Bernice smiled back.
"Imagine this, Bernice. You sit back down and I walk out. It is possible."
"But I can't do that. You're the princess, and this is a dangerous place. You'll need to be chaperoned for your own safety. We'll need Hilfred to escort us as well. Hilfred!" she called. The door popped open and the bodyguard stepped in, bowing to Arista.
"Did you need something, Your Highness?"
"No."
"Yes," Arista said, and pointed at Bernice.
"Keep her here. Sit on her. Tie her up. Hold her at sword point if you must, but I'm leaving and I don't want her following me."
The old maid looked shocked and put both hands to her cheeks in surprise.
"You're going out, Your Highness?" Hilfred asked.
"Yes, yes, I'm going out," she exclaimed, throwing her arms up. "I may roam the halls of this cabin. I may go to watch the contest. Why, I might even leave the stockade altogether and wander into the forest. I could get lost and die of starvation, eaten by a bear, tumble into the Nidwalden and get swept over the falls. But I'll do so alone."
Hilfred stood at attention. His eyes stared back at hers. His mouth opened and then closed.
"Is there something you want to say?" she asked, her tone harsh.
Hilfred swallowed.
"No, Your Highness."
"At least take your cloak," Bernice insisted, holding it up. Arista sighed, snatched it from her hands, and walked out. The moment she left, regret set in. Storming down the corridor, dragging the cloak, she paused. The look on Hilfred's face left her feeling miserable. She recalled having a crush on him as a girl. He was the son of a castle sergeant, and he used to stare at her from across the courtyard. Arista had thought he was cute. Then one morning she had woken to fire and smoke. He saved her life. Hilfred had been just a boy, but he had run into the flaming castle to drag her out. He spent 2 months suffering from burns and coughing fits that caused him to spit up blood. For weeks he awoke screaming from nightmares. As a reward, King Amrath appointed Hilfred to the prestigious post of personal bodyguard to the princess. But she had never thanked him, nor forgiven him for not saving her mother. Her anger was always between them. Arista wanted to apologize, But it was too late. Too many years had passed, too many cruelties, followed by too many silences like the one that had just hung between them.
"What's going on?"
Arista heard Thrace's voice and walked toward it.
"What's wrong, Thrace?"
The princess found the farmer's daughter and the deacon in the main hallway. The girl was dressed in her thin chemise nightgown. They both looked concerned.
"Your Highness," the girl called to her, "do you know what's happening? Why is the bell ringing?"
"The contest is starting soon, if that's what you mean. I was on my way to watch. Are you feeling better? Would you like to come?" Arista found herself asking. She was aware of the irony, but being with Thrace was not the same as being escorted by Bernice and Hildred.
"No, you don't understand. Something must be wrong. It's dark. No one would ring the bell at night."
"I didn't hear a bell," Arista said, pulling the cloak over her shoulders.
"The village bell," Thrace replied. "I heard it. It's stopped now."
"It's probably just part of the combat announcement."
"No."
Thrace shook her head, and the deacon mimicked her.
"That bell is only rung in emergencies, dire emergencies. Something is terribly wrong."
"I'm sure it's nothing." "You forget. There's practically an army outside, just itching for their chance to fight.
Anyway, we certainly can't find out standing here."
Arista took Thrace's hand and led them out to the courtyard. Because it was the second night, the event had moved into full extravagance. Outside, the high grassy yard of the manor's hill was set up like a pavilion at a tournament joust. The raised mound of the manor's motte offered a perfect view of the field below. Colourful awnings hung stretched above rows of chairs, with small tables holding steins of mead, ale, and bowls of berries and cheese. The Archbishop and Bishop Saldor sat together near the centre, while several other clergy and servants stood watching the distant action unfolding on the hillside beyond the castle walls.
"Oh, Arista, my dear," Saldor called to her. "Come to see history being made, have you? Good. Have a seat. That's Lord Rufus out there on the field. It seems he tires of waiting for his crown. But the vile beast is late in showing this evening, and I think it's making his lordship a tad irritated. Do you see how he paces his stallion? So like an emperor to be impatient."
"Who is to come after Rufus?" Arista asked, remaining on her feet, looking down at the field below.
"After?"
Saldor looked puzzled.
"Oh, I'm not sure, actually. Well, I hardly think it matters. Rufus will likely win tonight."
"Why is that?" Arista asked. "It isn't a matter of skill, really, is it? It's a matter of bloodline. Is Lord Rufus suspected of bearing some known ties to the Imperial family?"
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact, he has claimed such for years now."
"Really?" Arista questioned. "I've never heard of him ever making such a boast."
"Well, the Church doesn't like to promote unproven theories or random claims, but Rufus is indeed a favourite here. Tonight will prove his words, of course."
"Excuse me, Your Grace," Thomas said with a bow.
He and Thrace stood directly behind Arista, both still appearing as nervous as mice.
"Do you happen to know why the village bell has rung?"
"Hmm? What's that? The bell? Oh, that! I've no idea. Perhaps some quaint method the villagers use to call people to dinner." "But, Your Grace—"
Thomas was cut off.
"There!"
Saldor shouted, pointing into the sky as the Gilarabrin appeared and swooped into the torchlight.
"Oh, here we go!"
the Archbishop shouted excitedly, clapping his hands.
"Everyone, pay attention to what you see here tonight, for surely many people will ask how it came to be."
The beast descended to the field, and Lord Rufus trotted forward on his horse, which he had had the foresight to blind with a cloth bag to prevent it from witnessing the pending horror. With his sword held aloft, he shouted and spurred his mount forward.
"In the name of Novron, I, the true heir, smite thee!"
Rufus rose in the stirrups and thrust at the beast, which seemed startled by the bold confidence of the knight. Lord Rufus struck the chest of the creature, but the blow glanced away uselessly. He struck again and again, but it was like striking stone with a stick. Lord Rufus looked shocked and confused. Then the Gellarabrin slew Rufus and his horse with one casual swipe of a claw.
"Oh, dear Lord!"
the Archbishop cried, rising to his feet in shock. A moment later, the shock turned to horror as the beast cast out its wings and, rising, bathed the hillside in a torrent of fire. Those in the yard staggered backward, spilling drinks and knocking over chairs. One of the pavilion legs toppled, and the awning fell askew as people began to rush about. With the hillside alight, the beast turned toward the castle and, rising higher, let forth another blast that exploded the wooden stockade walls into sheets of flame. The fire spread from dry log to dry log until the flame swept fully around, ringing the castle. It didn't take long for those buildings close to the walls, those roofed with thatch, to catch, and soon the bulk of the lower castle and even the walls surrounding the manor house were burning. With the light of the fire surrounding them, it was impossible to see where the Gellarabrin had gone. Blind as to the whereabouts of the flying nightmare, and feeling the intensity of the heat growing all around them, the servants, guards, and clerics alike scattered in terror.
"We need to get to the cellar!"
Thomas shouted, but amid the screams and the roar of the flames devouring the wood, few heard him. Thomas took hold of Thrace and began to pull her back toward the manor. With her free hand, Thrace grabbed Arista's arm, and Thomas pulled both back up the slope. In shock, Arista put up no resistance as they dragged her from the yard. She had never experienced anything like this. She saw a man on fire running down the slope, screaming, thrashing about as flames spiraled up his body. A moment later, he collapsed, still burning. There were others, living pyres racing blindly about the yard in ghastly brilliance, one by one collapsing on the grass. By instinct, Arista looked for the protection of Hilfred, but somewhere in her soup-like mind, she remembered she had ordered him to remain on guard in her room. He would be looking for her now. Thrace held her arm in a vice grip as the three moved in a human chain. To her left, she saw a soldier attempt to breach the wall. He caught on fire and joined the throng of living torches, screaming as his clothes and skin burned away. Somewhere not far off, where the fire had spread to the forest, a tree trunk exploded with a tremendous crack. It rattled the building.
"We have got to get down in the cellar," Thomas insisted. "Quickly! Our only hope is to get underground. We need—"
Arista felt her hair blowing in a sudden wind. Thrump, thrump. Deacon Thomas began praying aloud as out of the smoke-clouded sky the Gellarabrin descended upon them. Chapter 12 Smoke and Ash. Crawling out of the well into the grey morning light, Hadrian entered an alien world. Dahlgren was gone. Only patches of ash and some smouldering timber marked the missing homes, but even more startlingly was the absence of trees. The forest that had hugged the village was gone. In its place was a desolate plain, scorched black. Limbless, leafless poles stood at random, tall, dark spikes pointing at the sky. Fed by smouldering piles, smoke hung in the air like a dull grey fog,
hiding the sky behind a hazy cloud from which ash fell silently like dirty snow, blanketing the land. Pearl came out of the well. Not surprisingly, she said nothing as she wandered about the scorched world, stooping to turn over a charred bit of